Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products.
Get a free audiobook of your choice at audibletrial.com/outnowpodcast.
Hello, this is Guillermo del Toro, and you're listening to Out Now Podcast.
Just kidding, that was me, Abe. I'm not on the show this week, but we're talking about Independence Day Resurgence.
Wait a minute, I forgot my introduction.
We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and as always, this is not Abe, because he is not here. Abe is unfortunately away this week, and I really wanted to know what he thought of this week's movie, but regardless, Out Now is a film podcast where Abe and I discuss new movies weekly, we cover some various movie topics, jump into a spoiler-free review, then jump back into other fun movie topics. This week's episode is 245, 245. Is something that Abe would comment on, but he's not here. So the movie we're discussing this week is Independence Day, Resurgence. And joining us tonight to talk Independence Day, Resurgence, we have from Forbes, contrary to popular belief, he was not strangled to death by an alien last week. It's Scott Mendelson.
I get strangled to death by an alien every week.
And from Fast Film Reviews, hello boys, he's back. It's Mark Hoban.
Hi everyone.
All right. There was a good amount of time where I was looking forward to reading a Randy Quaid quote on this podcast. Now I've done so, and I can move on from there. How are you guys doing today?
I'm doing well.
Good. Let's see. Let's get to some show notes here. First things first, we have a banner contest going. We've had this going for a good chunk of the month right now. On our Facebook page, facebook.com/outnowpodcast, we have a banner photo currently, and it's a little outdated. I thought, why not give our listeners a chance to submit new banners? It would be super fun. We figured if you wanted to submit something, appropriate for everybody that kind of has a theme of summer movies to it, that obviously incorporates Out Now with Aaron and Abe in some fashion, that'd be great. We've got a few entries so far. They're really fun, and I think the next episode is when we'll end this contest. So if you guys
1994's Melody and Griff, the classic Milk Money.
With Ed Harris?
Yes.
So if you know they don't want us to submit a banner, just go do so on our Facebook page or our email, outnowpodcast@gmail.com. And the person whose banner we pick will send them a Blu-ray prize. So yeah, that one's coming close to an end here. Yeah, next week's episode will be when we announce which one will win. And as I said, we got some cool ones, so be sure to get yours in. What else? New commentary is up in honor of Independence Day, Resurgence. We talked about Roland Emmerich's The Day After Tomorrow, Brandon Maxwell and Cullen and I. And that was a fun recording. And we did our best. We realized there's not a lot that happens in that movie, so we have a lot of tangents going on in for The Day After Tomorrow. A lot of walking through the snow by Dennis Quaid takes place.
Oh yes, that second half of that movie, dear God.
Yeah, but you know what? We did it anyway. We did the commentary. It was everything. What else? iTunes reviews and ratings. Good to get those. Helps out the show. Helps other people find the show. If you want to log on to iTunes, search Out Now with Aaron and Abe. You can find our show pretty easily. Give us a star rating. That'd be great. And if you want to string together some words to form some kind of review sentence, that'd also be great. So thank you in advance for those. Let's see. Last brief catch-up here. Obviously, Scott, you write about box office on a very fairly weekly basis, if not daily basis. That's fair to say, right?
Pay no attention to my ID4 predictions.
Yeah. on Saturdays and Sundays, I think it's almost on an hourly basis.
Seems that way.
It feels like it.
Yeah. We obviously Mark, Scott, and I, among others, are all in the summer gamble of this year and Independence Day.
Why are you bringing this up?
I'm bringing it up because I want to talk about Independence Day, Mark.
Because you know you're doing well.
I don't want to talk about it because Finding Dory's doing amazing. That's not the problem I have here. Independence Day, it made $41 million?
Yes.
And the thing is, I didn't want to be put into a position where I'm rooting against Finding Dory because I like that movie. But I didn't put it as my number one. So now I'm like hoping it doesn't, but it's going to.
I mean, I'm pretty happy. I mean, it's been a few – we've been doing this contest for a few years, and I always seem to not know what to do with Pixar, and it's finally paying off for me.
It happened before with Toy Story 3 and Iron Man – 2, was it?
Yes.
That summer, yeah, that was before
that
this
summer,
podcast.
But, sort of a little bit of a deja vu of that.
It's Scott, I believe it's having a similar run to Toy Story 3.
Yes, frighteningly so. Toy Story 3 dropped 46% in its second weekend, while Finding Nemo dropped 45%, despite a slightly larger opening weekend.
So it's doing better than Toy Story 3.
Yes. Not adjusted for inflation.
All right. Well, yeah. Obviously, there's still plenty of summer to go, and having the number one film predicted is not the, you know, that's not the key to winning the summer gamble.
Ben-Hur!
Yes. It's having the most gumption. Okay, moving on. Let's get to know everybody. Each week we ask each other a few questions, try to set the tone for the podcast. We better get to know everybody.
Know everybody.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you to my special guest here. I have a cameo appearance from the lovely Anna Bosch, who has, since Abe is out, she's going to ask a know everybody question, everybody.
Yeah, hello, everyone.
Hey.
Hi, Mark.
Hello.
So my question goes to Independence Day film, the callback of Will Smith dragging that alien through the desert, and he says, I could have been at a barbecue. And so my question is for both all three of you is, what is your favorite 4th of July barbecue food?
Brisket. Maybe tri-tip, sorry.
All right. Mark, got a barbecue preference?
I just like a nice steak.
I'm a ribs guy myself. I like beef ribs. So if there's ribs on a barbecue, that's good for me.
Sounds some good.
Good beans as well. Some barbecue baked beans. That'd be good. So yeah, that's what I got.
Yep.
Here's my question. What vehicle would you try to outrun the end of the world in? Would you go for style or would you go for utility?
Well, if I want to live, I'd probably go for utility.
So what would you shoot for? What would you drive in? Judd Hirsch pulled off a school bus.
A time machine?
A time machine.
That was because that was what was available.
He still pulled it off, Mark.
And with a bunch of kids on board, too.
I'm going to go with time machine.
Okay, Scott has time machine, which is a good pick.
I'd say rocket ship.
There you go, rocket ship. Okay. On any thoughts on this?
Let's see. That time machine was a pretty good one.
Would this be like a DeLorean time machine? Is that what you have your eye on, Scott?
Well, probably not a refrigerator. a vehicle of some time that would move and also travel through time.
Okay.
To stop this war before it ever began.
I like the time machine, but I would want it to be like as a Jeep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A Wrangler.
Yes. Of
okay.
course.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're specific. A Batmobile that travels through time.
Okay.
Either the first Burton one or the sleek remodel from the animated series in the 90s, which was the Burton one whittled down to its bare components.
Pretty much, yeah. All right. Well, Anna, thank you very much for supplying our cameo appearance to fill in for Abe.
You're welcome. That was quite fun. Have a good podcast.
Thank you. Okay. And that's how you play.
Know everybody.
Know everybody.
Thank you, Mark. all right, let's move on. Now let's get down. Now, quickies. There's no way.
TM.
Thank you, Mark.
I'm on it.
Picking up the slack. Each week out now, we have a movie with the outside toys during the week, outside the movies that take during the week. I'm not quickies.
TM.
Okay. Mark, have you seen any other movies this week?
Well,
or
not
recently that you want to bring up?
Yeah. Well, so like everyone else, I've seen Finding Dory. And I enjoyed it. I didn't think it topped the original, but I thought it's a little bit more frivolous and silly. And so maybe for that reason, it didn't replace the feelings I have for the original. However, I think the movie does kind of go off in its own sort of bizarre, zany direction, and it forges its own identity that way. And I think it's a good-natured, hilarious film. I enjoyed it, and I think it's obviously a huge hit. So me recommending it is not going to change anybody's mind, but it's definitely worth seeing.
We have a devoted subset of people that hate your opinions, Mark. So I don't know. Maybe they won't go see it. No, I'm kidding. I think we're all pretty much in line with you on that one. As far as it's not outdoing its predecessor, and it's not It does certainly go off in a zany direction. I completely agree with you on that one. But it still is entertaining, for sure. And that's certainly working for Scott and I, who have it as our number one picks of the box office on the gamble.
That should have been obvious.
Scott, any movies you've seen this week?
Oh, quite a few, actually. I saw The Neon Demon. couple weeks back, but it's open this week. I enjoyed it. It's one of those movies where it's all subtext. Not much happens in the present tense, but I think most of us know that going in. It looks gorgeous, well acted, lots of striking, bizarro images. So if you know what you're getting into, go for it. Let's see.
Visually, it looks, I haven't seen it, but visually it looks beautiful. So
yeah, Refn's like his visual eye is very good as far as its kind of tracking shots through like these very colorful sets and whatnot. It has a, my callback was it was a lot like Italian horror films. Honestly, it has a lot of a lot of good color.
Oh,
Suspiria. Like Suspiria is a very
that's high praise, I think.
I mean, as far as its kind of cinematography and the soundtrack's very good, but I mean, Cliff Martinez done some great work on even Only God Forgives, which I'm not a fan of. I really like that soundtrack.
So. Okay, yeah, that was my next question: is how would you compare it to Only God Forgives?
It's better than that movie.
It is better. I liked it more than Drive.
Yeah, but you're one of the few that didn't like Drive.
Yeah, I'm one of the few that didn't like.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Drive is like hallowed ground in my opinion.
Yeah. Hunt for the Wilder People is awesome. I saw it a few weeks ago. Came out this week in very limited release. Hopefully it'll go a little bit wider. Directed by the guy that did What We Do in the Shadows, which I caught up with after the fact and enjoyed.
Taika Waititi, yeah.
Yes, and of course he's doing the next Thor film next. But this film, Sam Neill is wonderful. Surprisingly warm from an actor that I don't necessarily associate with particularly warm performances. And it's really terrific.
He's super warm in Event Horizon. What are you talking about?
My mistake. And then I did see The Free State of Jones. I appreciate what Gary Ross was trying to do, but it felt like more of a very bland documentary as opposed to a narrative feature. I think there's a case to be made that not every somewhat interesting story needs to be made into a movie. You know, not every story is inherently, not every biopic is inherently cinematic.
Here's a question I have about that one, Free State of Jones, because obviously I saw it too, and I also did not like the film. And I wonder, obviously, the movie revolves around Matthew McConaughey's character, Newton Knight, and as opposed to other kind of maybe more fictional or ones that are rooted less in history, there's, you know, essentially a white savior character, so to speak. And
yes.
I wonder, despite the fact that the movie's focused on Newton Knight, I found, Masrhala Ali, who's on House of Cards, among other things, his character Moses. I wonder if the movie could have benefited from taking place around, you know, his character, with Newton Knight being more of a kind of a background figure.
I think by default, yes, because it'd be something that we haven't seen that much before.
Where you have
and even, you know, even as a two-hander, it would have been at least a little bit different.
Yeah, yes. I'm talking about a slave character. The film is set during the Civil War.
Yes.
And you have a Confederate soldier who essentially deserts his group and doesn't want to go to the Union either. He just kind of forms his own sort of union, this Free State of Jones, and he reunites a number of other deserters, farmers, and slaves that, you know, just don't want any part in the war whatsoever.
But no, I really, really, really disliked it. I felt bad for really, really disliking it. So it's a lose-lose.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I also, you know, you want to like it. And Gary Freestead Jones. He changed his name. Gary Ross. He's a talented writer for sure. His directing work goes here or there. I'm a huge Pleasantville fan, and I like Seabiscuit well enough. And I like the first Hunger Games, but I mean, I don't think it's necessarily his directorial hand that made it the best thing it could be. But
Gary Ross wrote Big also.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, his writing, I mean, he wrote Big, he wrote Dave. He's earned his stars when it comes to screenwriting.
And when is this podcast airing?
Tuesday.
Never mind. To be continued.
Some movie you saw that you can't talk about.
Something like that.
I'm pretty sure it has to do with The King of the Jungle. Let's.
You just have to put your faith in what you most believe in.
Yeah. Okay. I saw The Shallows. Anna and I saw The Shallows the other day.
Yes.
But this is the shark attack film starring Blake Lively from director Yom Kalet Sara, who's specialized in Liam Neeson action movies for the past few years, but has passed the torch on to the most likely recipient. And the film the film revolves around Lively's character who's surfing in a secret beach in Mexico, getting caught in kind of near the shore, but kind of trapped by a great white shark that's kind of circling her as she attempts to figure out how to, you know, survive this scenario. And it's an efficient thriller. It you know, it's like 90 minutes, doesn't waste too much time. Lively, who I've never really had any opinion on as an actress, mainly because she just hasn't really done it. Like, she was in what movies is Lively in? Green Lantern?
The Age of Adele.
I never saw the Age of Adeline.
She's excellent in that.
I never saw the Age of Adeline.
In The Town, a movie I don't otherwise care for.
Oh, yeah,
and she was terrific in the Sister in the Traveling Pants movies. That was basically her debut for all intents and purposes. And she was terrific in that film.
What's the show? Is it Gossip Girl? Is that
the show? That I've never seen.
Okay.
So I can't speak to that.
But no, as far as you know, that for the performance that has to hold this movie together, essentially, she's fine. Like, she does her job, but the movie, and obviously, yes, there's the character Steven Seagal that is present as well. You know, as far as shark movies go, this is one of the better ones I've seen in a while that doesn't involve tornadoes.
I was going to say, how does it compare to Deep Blue Sea?
It's better than Deep Blue Sea. Deep Blue Sea is more of that's. I'm not a big fan of using the term guilty pleasure because I have no guilt about the movies that I like regardless, but it fits there. Where
Deep Blue Sea is a masterpiece for about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Or what about Open
Water? And we all know which 3 minutes.
Yes, the Sam Jackson stuff. I'm not a huge Open Water fan.
Oh, no.
I actually liked Open Water 2, oddly enough.
Which involves no sharks, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. You're right.
No, it's suggested. There is a shark in the water. There is a part where it swims by, but I don't think it becomes a...
Which movie are you talking about?
Open Water?
Open Water 2.
But Scott's talking about Open Water 2, the sequel.
Oh, no. I was talking about the original.
No, Open Water has sharks. I mean, there's a great shot towards the end of Open Water where the camera's kind of floating in the water and underneath there's like a ton of sharks.
Right.
And it's... But I hated the character so much. I couldn't... I admire the idea, but it's just like I'm not on board with what you're selling me. But The Shallows, good, efficient thriller. Does its job.
Agreed.
And root for the seagull, obviously, is the major take home that I don't want to make sure that I should communicate. Yeah?
Also, The Secret Life of Pets is very charming. It's not great. Too many dogs, not enough cats. That's a problem. Even my daughter complained.
That's what you said in I Am Legend, too, right?
Yes. But no, it's going to make a lot of money. Because it starts well, it ends well, and the middle's fine.
Okay.
I can see that pets like heavy metal music, according to the trailer, so I know that much.
Yeah.
Poodles, anyway.
All right. That's on our quickies.
TM.
Thank you. Let's move on. Now let's get to our trailer talk. We talk about one of the newest movie trailers of the week, and this week we have Jack Reacher, : Never Go Back, which is not the greatest, I think, title for a sequel to get audiences in theaters. Never Go Back, guys. This is, of course, the follow-up to Jack Reacher, the Christopher McQuarrie film starring Tom Cruise, based off the Lee Child novel. And Tom Cruise returns as Jack Reacher.
Things are gonna get easier.
Tom Cruise returns as Jack Reacher. This time he's, I think, looking to help an old military buddy played by Cody Smulders, who's become a fugitive, and he does his Jack Reacher thing, which involves beating up people and probably talking smart while doing it. Scott, I believe you're a fan of Jack Reacher.
I was.
What do you think about this?
I think it looks fine. I hope that the trailer is overselling the amount of action, because what I liked about the first film is that it was basically a character-driven mystery movie with a bit of action, here and there, and then a big set piece at the very end of the film. Now, of course, the trailer, so you're going to sell the spectacle, but I hope it's as much committed to just telling a good mystery as it is, with the guns and the beatings and the explosions and all that. I'm certainly on board. I like everybody involved. I like Ed Zwick, the new director.
Reteaming from The Last Samurai.
Which I also enjoyed. Hopefully this will also have a second act scene involving ninjas. Because we need more ninjas.
Yeah, I remember I saw The Last Samurai with my dad. I remember seeing I remember that the whole ninja action sequence, and it was like the, I think like the day of opening, and that whole ninja thing goes down, and he and the other like main samurai and Ken Watanabe are all like, they're all fighting. Then like the scene ends, and the music's very like, it's very drum heavy, and then like, so it all stops, and then it was like really exciting, and then one guy in the audience like, woo! Like, it was like, oh, yeah. We all had that same reaction, and he voiced it for us.
No, I was fortunate to see that at a paid sneak preview a week before it opened, mm-hmm. Thanksgiving weekend, and we had no idea that it's in the middle of this movie there was going to be a giant scene involving ninjas. And that's just something you just don't get all that much, which is odd, because ninjas are such iconic characters in, you know, pop culture and what have you. You'd think they'd show up in more movies, but they don't.
Like Ninja Assassin,
unless you just don't see them. Unless what?
Like Ninja Assassin, for example. You'd think there'd be more ninjas in that movie.
You'd think there'd be more assassinations in that movie, but there's not.
Yeah.
The title's very misleading.
Anyway, Mark, what'd you think of the trailer for Jack Reacher?
Well, so I actually never saw the original Jack Reacher, so I'm probably not the best person to comment on it, but I actually thought the trailer was pretty interesting. I'm kind of a fan of trailers without lots of quick edits and ones that show more drama and allow us to get into the scene. And so that part where he's sitting in the diner and he's handcuffed and he says, okay, the next 30 seconds, the phone's going to ring and you're going to walk out of here in handcuffs. That was good. And I kind of like the way that, you know, you start to see that his prophecy is coming true. So I was intrigued by that. It actually, if anything, kind of got me wanting to like actually watch Jack Reacher, the movie.
You're a Tom Cruise fan, aren't you, Mark?
I am. You know, actually, I've seen virtually every – so I didn't see Jack Reacher, and I never saw Far and Away, but I virtually have seen – and I don't think I ever saw Lion for Lambs, but everything else.
You're not missing anything there.
but I've seen everything else that he's ever done.
I like how you offhand knew that you hadn't seen Far and Away. I like that that's like a goat. It's like, I never saw that one.
I once went back and I said, oh my gosh, I've seen that. And then I had to go back to Far and Away before
I
found
it. Like you've seen Taps, but you haven't seen Far and Away.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, Taps is, you know, Sean Penn and Tom Cruise. But anyway, I like Tom Cruise and I don't know why I never saw Jack Reacher, but anyway, I think this movie looks interesting. I mean, I guess he's kind of like a James Bond type person. I mean, maybe a little bit more.
My thoughts.
He uses his fists more.
But the way I describe Jack Reacher, he's Jason Bourne by way of Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, I like that.
He's a very well equipped person when it comes to solving scenarios, but he has a kind of like, he can wear Lee dungarees around kind of feel to him, if that makes
any sense.
He's
like the common man.
He's like kind of. Which is somewhat different from like the, like, you know, I mean, obviously there's casting controversy when Cruise is involved because Jack Reacher in the novels is supposed to be like 6'5 or something like that and like very burly and. Tom Cruise,
it's the movies.
Yes, I know. And Tom Cruise is obviously.
Shoot around that.
He's not that.
Dwayne Johnson was busy.
But I think there's stuff in the character that Cruise did well in the first Reacher film, and I have news for you, Mark. You're missing out on a good movie. You should go catch up on Jack Reacher. I think it does do a good job of emphasizing what you liked about that trailer.
Well, I haven't purposely like avoided it. It's for whatever reason, I just never saw it.
But yeah, I mean, aside from I like this trailer. I think it's fun. I think it does a little. I think it's tough to sell who Jack Reacher is. I mean, it does so in that kind of the first scene of the trailer where, Mark, you've described where he's kind of laying out the scenario that's going to happen. It has to kind of sell itself on the action, which is fine. It's just it makes it look somewhat like a random B action movie. But it has Tom Cruise involved, which I'd like to think people can realize, hey, he chooses his projects fairly carefully.
Right, definitely.
But I, as a fan of the first Jack Reacher, I am looking forward to the sequel. I like the kind of the way this person handles himself, and what I liked about the first film, and I know Scott, you agree on this, is that the violence is very much taken into account. Like the opening of that film involves a fairly shocking sniping incident, which I believe kind of things happened when that movie came out that I think gave it something of a controversial release, right? Wasn't there a shooting that took place?
Well, it was right after the Newtown shootings.
Yes, which was, you know, obviously horrible, and then you have a movie.
Yeah, it was a week afterwards.
You have a movie that's opening that has a kind of, you know, a horrific shooting event that's not played for anything but, you know, the devastating drama of having a random sniping event occur. So.
And it was, you know, a perfect example of violence that, frankly, you know, it's fine, but how the hell is it going to PG-13 type situation?
Yeah.
And it was a film that was to a certain extent about gun culture without being terribly critical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's there, but, you know, this was a time where, you know, people kind of wanted yellow highlighter type stuff, and that was not this movie.
The only real problem I think I might have with this movie is that the first one had me not only intrigued because I'm a big Christopher McQuarrie fan, The Way of the Gun's one of my favorite movies, and, you know, like, it is. It's one of my favorite movies.
No, I know where you're going.
But, I mean, it also had Werner Herzog as the main villain, which was amazing, because Werner Herzog, he needed the work, and so he took on the role of a villain, and it was intense. This movie, to my knowledge, does not have someone of the caliber of Werner Herzog, so I hope that it can supply something that you know, gives it that extra edge, much like the first one.
We wanted Terrence Malick, but it didn't happen.
That would have been the greatest thing. I believe I wrote a post actually on when I was writing for Ran Hollywood of
the
top like seven directors that should be the villain in Jack Reacher 2, which I'll definitely link to now. But
yes.
Jack Reacher, : Never Go Back, : that's the title, opens theaters October 21st. So we will see on that one.
Because it's scary.
All right. Let's move on now. Let's get to our main review for Independence Day, : Resurgence.
On this day in 1996, the world escaped the clutches of extinction.
Your father was the bravest man I've ever seen.
We all lost someone we love.
But in their sacrifice, we found the technology to build a stronger and safer Earth. Because our survival is only possible when we stand together.
Oh my God. A distress call.
Why are they screaming?
They're not screaming. They're celebrating.
They're coming back. It has its own gravity. What goes up must come down.
Shouldn't we be nervous?
Yeah.
Okay, that should have been some of the trailer for Independence Day, : Resurgence. 20 years after Roland Emmerich left a stamp on the world via alien super lasers, we now have a sequel to the film that made Will Smith a superstar, albeit without the presence of the Fresh Prince this time around. In Independence Day Resurgence, Earth is at peace and filled with new technology, but that apparently did not prepare us for an even bigger threat. It will be up to Dr. Ian Malcolm, Thor's brother, Usher, not that Usher, the target of It Follows, Data, and bearded Bill Pullman to find a solution and save the planet again. Mark Hoban, where are you at on the Independence Day first film, and what do you have to say about this sequel?
So I'll confess that I didn't think that the original 1996 film was a great movie, but it was fun. And I'll acknowledge that the picture has become somewhat of a science fiction classic in the ensuing years. And I think what it did well was take, you know, some of Earth's major landmarks and then just blow them up in sort of a really kind of exciting spectacle that made audiences sort of cheer and cower and stuff over the spectacle of it all. So I enjoyed it to a certain extent. I didn't think it was the greatest film, but this film, I did not enjoy it. And I hate to cap on a film that has already gotten a lot of hate. It's pretty roundly, despised. But
I think it's at like in the 40s on Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, roundly despised is like, you know, I've seen some movies this year that have been roundly despised.
Yeah,
say that name?
I think it just doesn't handle what. Roland Emmerich is good at simple stories. His movies are never big on script. So this movie has a terrible script, but so does Independence Day, the original. That's not the problem. What he does well is set up these spectacles and gets you sort of excited over, you know, what the visual beauty of it all. And I don't even think that he bungles that in this film. We get this 30-minute formless exposition about the returning characters, that I think is very perfunctory. It's done with minimal amount of effort. I don't think I was literally nodding off in the first 30 minutes just with – and we're supposed to be – this is nostalgia. We should be excited to see these characters like Bill Pullman and Judd Hirsch and Jeff Goldblum again. But they don't – they don't even – I don't even think they seem excited to be back. I mean, Bill Pullman has post-traumatic stress disorder, so in as the ex-president, so he has an excuse. But anyway, we have this exposition, and they sort of set it up. Then we get this attack again, which we should have. I mean, that's what I was expecting. And it is so confusing, so badly mishandled. I could not figure out what was even happening. Apparently, Beijing and Dubai are being levitated, and then the buildings are dropped on top of London. And the ship is supposed to be, you know, 3,000 miles big. I didn't think that the film even had a sense of scope. Like, I wasn't even clear the sort of magnitude of what was happening. I think the special effects felt small and insular. I just think it bungled sort of a very basic thing that this film should be doing. And Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin, the producer, they're good at this kind of stuff. I mean, you know, say what you will about The Day After Tomorrow or the original Independence Day or 2012. They know how to blow stuff up. They know how to create a spectacle. I don't even think they did that in this movie. There is some hints of that at the very, very end with this sort of Godzilla-like creature, which we can go into that later, with the planes encircling it. That was kind of a hint of what this movie could have been. But I would say for the majority of the film, I thought it was really badly the manifestation of this attack was really badly handled. And I didn't care. The humanity is at stake, and I really couldn't care less whether people died or survived. And in the original movie, I did care. I mean, even though it wasn't a well-written film, I still think that they were able to captivate my imagination and my feeling in a way that this movie didn't. There's other problems with the film. I think.
We'll get there. Let's get to Scott here.
Okay,
Scott, where did you think of the Independence Days?
I am actually a big fan of the original Independence Day. I do think it is well written in the sense that it is well plotted, the fact that it is a disciplined narrative structure. Also that, you know, in 1996 it was cheap enough that they couldn't have this nonstop spectacle all the time, that they had to focus on character. They had to focus on, you know, conversation and interaction and plotting from point A to point B. You couldn't just have 2 hours of wall-to-wall mayhem. There's a discipline that's lacking in this film specifically, in the new film, sorry. But you're right. I mean, in terms of, you know, the things that Emmerich and Devlin usually do well, either together or separate, you know, for example, I really like White House Down quite a bit. Not because I think it's an exceptionally good action film, but because I like the characters a lot. I like the quality of the dialogue, conversations that they have with each other.
I think the action's pretty good in that movie, too.
The action is fine, but it wasn't what did anything for me.
Yes, I understand. Yeah.
You know, if I want crazy-ass action in a diehard White House movie, I'll watch the first 20 minutes of Olympus Has Fallen and, you know, feel guilty. but for this one, you know, it's – and I think part of it is it's a very short movie. It's about 2 hours long, which is about 25 minutes shorter than the first one.
With credits.
With credits. And it feels so much time – setting up something that turns out to be a red herring that also turns out to be something of a sequel setup. I'm being vague for now. We can go into that later if you want.
Talk about that too.
Yeah. So everything else is very rushed, very disjointed. The actual carnage that caps off the first act that's supposed to be the reason for the season is very arbitrary. There's no emotional feeling behind it. Emmerich makes the same mistake that he did in 2012, but frankly, it's far more problematic here, which he stages this, you know, world-ending disaster, but only makes sure that you care about whether person A outruns the carnage in time. Now, there's a little of that in the first Independence Day with the dumb stuff with the dog, but there's there's plenty of, oh my God, oh my God, people are dying. We're supposed to feel that way, and the characters feel that way. You know, the film takes a minute to pause and mourn and grieve and react in horror to what's actually happening. This film has almost no drama. The film has no feeling of consequence, and the characters don't seem to be that concerned about what's going on, so we're not that concerned about what's going on. The returning characters feel perfunctory. Jeff Goldblum, for all the buzz about Goldblum being Goldblum and taking charge this time, is given very little to do. Bill Pullman has an interesting arc, but he's barely in the movie. Brett Spiner, of all people, who died in the first one, and don't pretend anything otherwise.
He was in a coma, Scott. He didn't die.
Bullshit. Bullshit. All due respect, bullshit.
But you know what? I will say that despite the fact that he has a very weak excuse for why he's back, he is the most captivating proof of humanity in this entire production.
Yes, he has more. I think he has more screen time than any other returning character.
He does, and he was not exactly a huge character in the first film. He just kind of came in midway through the second act and suddenly started being a thing.
You know, then the new characters are frankly boring as buttered toast. I mean, I know I like to bag on Liam Hemsworth, and I think a quote-unquote movie star of a better caliber than Liam Hemsworth might have done more with what he was given, but he was given nothing. I mean, that's, you know, I'm not inclined to blame him for the utter block of wood that is his quote-unquote lead character.
Well, can I blame him? Like, so
sure, because absolutely.
What is the movie that got? I mean, obviously he was in those Hunger Games films, but what did Liam Hemsworth do again to be like in things?
Oh, absolutely. And I constantly use him as sort of a, you know, even Jai Courtney has a couple films from Australia that were pretty decent.
And he looks like he's having a blast in Suicide Squad.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I know we all like to pick on him, deservedly so, for sort of the arbitrary, the next big thing. But yeah,
the only thing I can think of is that he's related to Chris Hemsworth. And so that keeps his name in front of like casting agents' minds.
Well, he's in the triumvirate that is Jennifer Lawrence, Josh Hutcherson, and then him for Hunger Games. Regardless of the fact that he really doesn't do much in those Hunger Games movies, he's a part of those. Every time he pops up as like a lead character, and what he is, he's credited first in this movie. It's like, what did he do again?
He left into those Hunger Games movies. I don't know why he got cast, but
the film, frankly, doesn't have the I don't want to say courage. That's the wrong word. But he's really not the movie. Really doesn't have a lead character.
No.
I mean,
that's true of the original movie too. I think,
Pronounced heroes in it. You look at the first Independence Day, and you have Jeff Goldblum, Will Smith walking off of at the end of the movie, walking back from blowing up a mothership. Like, there's something there where you're like, these are heroes. I don't know who I'm supposed to exactly think that about in this movie.
Yeah, and they have I assume this is her stage name, Angela Baby, who is a musician, model, actress from China.
She's a Hong Kong model.
Yeah, which is fine. But she's there, you know, basically to be a piece of ass, all due respect. I mean, if that's offensive, it's supposed to be. I mean, she's there to be the romantic booby prize.
The casting agent should be the one,
The socially awkward nerd character. Some kind of, you know, male escapist fantasy.
So, there's these four characters, Jake, Dylan, Charlie, and Rain. And we mentioned all four of them. They form this squad of fighter pilots that are this quartet of vapidity. I mean, they are – I would have eliminated their entire story trajectories completely. Now, of course, that means that I would be eliminating like an hour of the movie, and so we'd have to shoot new stuff. But they're completely dreary. They have no – and I'm not – this movie shouldn't be about the soap opera. It should be about the special effects. But we do need soap opera. That's part of it. That's why Will Smith became a star in the original film, is because of his personality. There is no one to pick up the slack, and these four people are certainly not up to the task.
That's definitely my, kind of gripe with the film. There's no – it's not that the movie needed Will Smith, but it needed something to kind of make up for the lack of him.
Yes.
And it clearly doesn't have that. It tries to, you know, it promotes certain other actors. You get more Goldblooming out of Goldblum. You get more, like, eccentricities out of Dr. Oaken. And Bill Pullman, I don't know what he's doing. He's trying his hardest, though, so he's doing that. And you get more
Hirsch. There was also that Congolese warlord, Mbutu, sort of pops up.
Yeah, my favorite characters are the African warlord and the tour guide from White House Down. They make a fun pairing in this movie. Like
they're different. They're not, you know, you don't usually see a character like that as the hero in this kind of movie.
Yeah.
You know, he's the guy that, you know, menaces Lois Lane and then gets killed by Superman.
Exactly. I would say I appreciate this movie a little bit more than you guys do, but it's still not very good. Like, I was excited by this movie because I have not seen this kind of movie before. I didn't know what to expect from a sequel to Independence Day. Beyond, like, Destruction, I'm curious what a world after a giant alien attack that left, you know, all of the most famous landmarks, mainly in North America, what happens after those are destroyed. And this movie, Mark, you say you're nodding off in the first 30 minutes. I mean, despite it being a little scattershot in how it's delivering who these characters are, I was intrigued by, like, what the world building, honestly. I liked seeing that we've harvested alien technology, so we don't have helicopters anymore. We have, like, hover vehicles or whatnot. We have alien weaponry. We have space stations on the moon to help prepare us for next upcoming attack. Like, there's a lot of stuff like that I was like, all right, that's neat. I want to know more about this. But then, you know, yeah, it all shunts it aside so we can get to more aliens blowing up stuff. And I can say, yeah, it's, you know, this is, you know, coming off of the first film, which I'm a huge fan of. I recognize its flaws or whatnot, but I think it's a very enjoyable film that has a lot of great, it has a lot of heart in it. It's very earnest, which is what I think Emmerich's very good at. This movie, it lacks a kind of tangibility that the first one had. In addition to lacking kind of a major star to kind of, you know, center the whole thing, it lacks the kind of personality that comes with seeing how you put these movies together. Because that, you know, obviously the 96 movie came out in the 90s. It has some CGI in there, but it has a lot of practical effects. The White House explosion is a practical effect. There's a lot of stuff in there that's done with kind of a different kind of hand. Now, which is, I think, something that, Scott, you were kind of fearful of, and I think a lot of other people were too, is you're putting a movie like this that was built off of the spectacle at a time where every big movie is spectacle. So making this movie, it doesn't add anything that's all that new to what we're, you know, seeing here. And because of that, I'm getting what you've basically described as perfunctory kind of explosions, where I'm getting big destruction, but it's not doing anything that's all that different from other movies that handle big destruction. I could say I haven't seen a 3,000-mile-wide spacecraft before, but I would agree, Mark, that it does kind of have a lack of – it doesn't best emphasize the scope because that's impossibly big. So I think it's nearly impossible to emphasize that kind of scope.
Yeah, I thought that 30 minutes in when they're doing this sort of destruction scene, this is the part where they really needed to come to play. And the destruction scenes are confusing. I thought it was badly edited. I don't think there's any concept for geography. There's a part I still don't understand. They levitate Beijing and Dubai, and then they drop it on London.
Well, I'm
confusing. I didn't understand.
Not to rest too hard on that, but the logic is that this thing is so massive that it's like its gravity pulls all these buildings out of the ground, and then by the time it's kind of settled to like the location it needs to be in, it releases itself, so everything that's been collected falls, and that just happens to be where it fell at that point. It's confusing, but I guess that's the logic I came to grips with.
But that was what was so great about the original, is that you see the scene of the White House, and it almost seemed kind of almost naughty that you see this beam of light come down to the White House and just blow it up. Like, there's sort of a – I don't know. There was something exciting and terrorizing about that. None of that is in this movie. I don't even think there's an American landmark that it's blown up in this movie.
They tip because they have the White House nearly get blown up, and they don't do it, which I thought was kind of funny.
Right. So I'm fine with them blowing up landmarks throughout the world, but it would have helped to have something in the U.S. blown up.
It landed over the Atlantic. It wasn't going to get to the U.S.
Well, the carnage was, as you said, you know, very perfunctory, and we didn't feel anything. The special effects sequences in the first film are, I would argue, genuinely scary. I mean, there's a sense of dread when Jeff Goldblum whips around his keyboard and there's a countdown. And, oh, God, they have two pilots in the air and they all get shot down. It's like, oh, shit, that's what this is now. They really are coming to kill us. You know, and there is a sense of dread and horror, mounting horror, as it goes from that sequence to, you know, the big payoff that ends the first act and everything getting blown up.
I mean, I see what you're saying, Mark, where there's kind of a weird sensation that comes from seeing landmarks you're aware of get blown up by things in big spectacle movies. And that's what, I mean, that's what Irwin Allen essentially cashed in on when he made all the 70s ones, where you're like, it's right. Not that you're super happy that a giant cruise liner just got flipped over on its backside and like all these people die, but you're like, I haven't seen a giant cruise liner get flipped over before. That's something new to me. It sucks that these people died, but here you go. Independence Day is the same way, where it's like, you know, you just, I mean, the next shot of Independence Day after the explosion happens at the Statue of Liberty on its side. It's like, that's horrible, but I haven't seen that before. Like, it's an interesting thing to, like, kind of take into account. This movie, I agree with you guys. Like, there's not much of, like, there's no Goldblum, like, there's no him watching a clock and, like, waiting for some kind of inevitable doom to happen. It's more of like, oh, here we go again, and it with no real kind of patience to what that actually means for the scene. Like, there's no heart to it, which is a shame, which makes me come at a loss of what I'm trying to recommend here. But I think there is stuff. I think
there is the dark side.
There is stuff. Well, I don't think it's a good movie, but I do think I think there's stuff here. I do like seeing the kind of the returning cast. Some of them get really short shrift. Vivica Fox, who's like just around.
I felt like the returning. I wanted to see the returning cast, and that was nostalgia. But I don't think either they weren't giving anything to do, or they were just collecting a paycheck, or they were bored. I don't know what the problem was.
I think Goldblum was into it. I think Pullman was definitely into it, given what he was doing. Like, he seemed to be channeling something. And I mean, Hirsch was having fun here. I like to, and you mentioned yourself, Brett Spiner as Dr. Oaken. He was the most captivating character.
He was, yeah, by default.
By default, but he's still doing his thing.
I mean, the things – like, so I tried to search because I wanted to find things that I did like about the movie. I liked when Judd Hirsch is in his little boat and he's trying to outrun the spaceship. That's cute. I liked when Alien Gloop was thrown onto the car
bus, yeah.
And the windshield – or the bus or whatever, and the windshield wipers. I mean, these are really minor things, and I'm really like searching here. But that was cute. There was a little, like, you know, I kind of chuckled at that. And then I liked the sort of, I mean, it was almost like Godzilla at the end with the queen.
Yeah,
there's a big,
and like, kaiju fight in this movie.
Yeah, so that was good. At the very end, I was kind of like, okay, here is sort of where I start to get sort of excited by the spectacle of it all.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's ending, and then it's over. And
well, what's
ironically, like Roland Emmerich's Godzilla, which is a giant slog for the first 110 minutes, right, and then just, you know, pardon the pun, roars to life in the final chase scene. And I felt the same way. Like, where the hell has this movie been for the last 90 minutes?
What I can appreciate,
the editors
about,
have cut out an hour and a half, start the movie at this minute, and then say, now shoot new stuff.
Well, you mentioned Godzilla. What I like about this movie as far as its kind of climax goes is it's – Godzilla, my – among the many issues wrong with Emmerich's Godzilla is that it's all set during, like, the rain. Like, it's all rainy because, you know, effects are cheaper to do if you don't have to see everything so clearly. This movie, everything's in daylight. Like, there's no expenses.
Right.
I mean, the effects, you know, geography and scope-wise aside, I think the effects are pretty, I mean, spectacular as far as what we're seeing. But at the end, yes. I mean, there's a lot of things going on, and I can visibly see it. Like, I'm never by this kind of last 30-minute chunk we're discussing. It's all out in the daytime on the Salt Flats by Area 51, our favorite location for Area Independence Day movies, apparently. And it looks very good. Like, it's good-looking stuff, and it's very clearly going for what it's trying to be. And what I could also appreciate is that we've talked a bit about how there's no real sense of mourning for the fact that, like, huge disasters are happening. Ellipses again, but there's it kind of this age we're in where there's so much, you know, every time we see a dystopian film, it's all gray and, you know, sad and grim, or even, you know, various blockbusters that are set in quote-unquote modern times, it's very grim to look at. This is a very optimistic kind of film. Like, it has a kind of upbeatness to it that I admired. I could have used more personality, heart, and earnestness as opposed to bland characters and a lack of a more coherent story. But I also like that it wasn't, like, it wasn't reveling in how dark it could get. I thought that was nice. That was a better touch.
I think you can have it both ways. You know, and yes. I would argue that, frankly, the first Independence Day and something like White House Down, which is a very violent picture, frankly, but is never overwhelmed by a sense of doom and gloom.
Yeah, but that comes at a different age, I would argue, too, of that first Independence. I mean, you know what I'm talking about, Scott.
That was a film that very, you know, carefully balanced this is a lighter, optimistic, crowd-pleasing film with we just killed a million people. And frankly, that's a criticism the film has always faced. I would argue it does balance that successfully. This film, I think, goes too far in the opposite direction of just not acknowledging the drama at all. For example, I'm not going to spoil anything here. There's a scene close to the halfway point where something really, really awful happens to characters we're supposed to care about. And right as the awful thing's about to happen, we cut to Dr. Oaken being goofy with a space laser. And yep. And that's sort of the moment where it's okay. This isn't working. It's a film that's afraid of its own drama, and it does that a lot. I thought in the film where it's afraid to confront the horror of its own scenario, or even acknowledge the horror of its own scenario. As a result, the characters don't feel anything, and we don't feel anything. So it feels like, I mean, I don't want to quote somebody else, but William. I don't want to mispronounce his name. He writes for Crave.
Babini?
Yes. He mentioned offhand that it feels like the Saturday morning cartoon spinoff version of Independence Day. And I think he liked the movie a little bit more than I did, but I think that's frankly pretty accurate.
You know what? To me, it seems like the Sci-Fi Channel version of Independence Day.
Yeah.
Their original movies.
Yeah.
If I saw this on the Sci-Fi Channel, you know, and it was like presented as this sort of direct-to-TV kind of thing, then I would be like, oh, okay, this is actually kind of good. I mean, for what it is. But as a theatrical mega-budget blockbuster, it's seriously inept. I mean, yeah. I was shocked.
I wonder why that has to be. Yeah?
Well, yeah, I honestly do. I have a theory. I might write about this on Tuesday, but I'll try it out for the club.
We got
here.
The scoop. Listen up, guys. No.
You're like the small comedy club that I test my material on. Without going into spoilery details, I mean, you've seen the movie, so you know what I'm talking about. The film spends a lot of time setting up a very specific sequel, setting up a very specific plot line that will happen in the sequel, a plot line that I think would have made a much more interesting movie. Now, what I'm thinking... There's a way to construct this script in a three-act structure, so at least the third act is that material that they set up at the end of this film. But if you do that, you don't have a third film.
Right. So that would have been a better movie, though.
Yeah. So I think they basically sabotaged this film, made us sit through an entire rehash of the first one, just so we could, quote-unquote, set up the movie that they really wanted to make, which is... what's going to happen in the third one, which probably is never now going to happen. Because if they had done, you know, first act, reestablish this world. Second act, fight off the aliens. Third act, not talking about what I'm talking about because I don't want to spoil anything. That would have been a far more satisfying sequel. But then you would have had no place obvious to go for the third film.
That sounds like a long movie.
This is a short movie.
It is, yeah.
So make it longer.
One of my big issues on this movie.
edit out some of those fighter pilot characters.
Yeah.
Rain and Charlie and whatever, Jake and, you know.
One of my big issues on this movie, which is what you're talking about, Scott, essentially, is that everyone feels like they're in a hurry. Like, it feels like it's a protracted, like, Aaron Sorkin West Wing scene of everyone, like, hurriedly walking down hallways and talking to get through, like, various plot points at, like, lightning pace. And
yes.
It doesn't allow the movie any breathing room. So, yeah, you don't get those scenes of people, like, reflecting on, like, giant atrocities that just took place because alien spaceships arrived, which there's a silly fun to have with that, which is what the first film cashed in on very well. And you
don't get the very moving moments, like, with, you know, the many, many moving moments of Jeff Goldblum and his father. And to me, that's what makes the movie, watching it, you know, 20 years after the fact, that's what gets me is the character relationships, not the spectacle.
And I can, yes, and things like when, like, the president's wife dies and things. I mean, there's a lot of, like, good stuff in there that, like, it's melodramatic, but it works. It's good melodrama within
it's
this movie.
It's terrific melodrama.
This movie, it lacks the, like, it could go like a couple ways. Like, it could go like a more of a Jurassic World route where it just gives completely trafficking in nostalgia, but it still works to its degree. This movie, it doesn't, like, find that balance. And I wonder, you know, Roland Emmerich, who's coming back to do this, as opposed to, like, a new director coming on to take over, like, a story they wrote or something, him and Dean Devlin wrote together, like, it occurs to me, it's like, has Emmerich really grown as a director over, like, the course of his career?
That's a good point. I cannot believe that Roland Emmerich directed this film. It feels like something that was given to someone else that didn't have a familiarity with the property and sort of did what they thought would be good. This doesn't have the feel of the original film. I mean, even in the basic, you know, setting, I feel like they've really, I mean, it's shocking. So, yeah, he's gone backward. Seriously. I mean, he was never, like, you know, he was never,
yeah, he's not,
you know,
he's not a top-tier, like, director, but he's a guy that knows how to blow stuff up pretty well.
Right. He's been very successful. He has some very successful films. This is not one of them, rightfully so, but he has had films that were successes. I mean, even silly things like Stargate are, I can enjoy those because they're just sort of visually bizarre and fun. And this just didn't have any of that sense of joy that I associate with his good films.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Stargate. You know, I never have been. I understood why it was a big hit back then. But that, you know, it's filled with, you know, interesting actors having good dramatic moments. I mean, it's, I would argue, the warmest Jeff Spader's ever been, James Spader's ever been.
Yep.
I mean, he's downright gee whiz heroic in that film.
That and the Watcher, of course, but, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I like The Watcher. I will defend that film. But I see that that's a movie that I like more than the people that made it. So, oh well. But no, I mean, I like Independence Day quite a bit. I like The Patriot. I think it's a, you know, it's a shameless melodrama, but I think it works like that.
I think 2012 is awesome.
Yeah. I love the Oliver Platt, Chiwetel Ejiofor stuff. That's, you know, that's 4-star material in an otherwise 3-star, 2.5-star movie. But it, you know, this is, that's half the movie. That makes it pretty darn good.
I mean, I would actually argue that – I'm not positive, but I would say this is probably, in my opinion, Roland Emmerich's worst film. I don't –
Oh, 10,000 BC is a horrible thing.
I still enjoy that more than this.
Oh, no.
Fair enough.
I cannot go
that
there.
Just, that has – that. I mean, there's a simplicity to that film that doesn't – you know, that doesn't attempt a lot, but I still, I mean, and also you can enjoy that film more on camp. This, there's really,
I don't know.
I couldn't enjoy this even on a camp level. This is just bad.
Yeah. I will say this. It's worse than Stargate. It's worse than Universal Soldier. It's worse than The Day After Tomorrow. And those are Emmerich films that I'm not super duper crazy about. Again, I can appreciate Universal Soldier and Stargate, especially after the fact, but they never did much for me, and they're certainly worse than the ones that I like. Patriot, 2012, Independence Day, and I love White House Down.
White House Down.
That's why I conned myself into thinking this was going to be a big hit and a good movie, because I liked the last few Roland Emmerich pictures, not counting his attempts at art.
Stonewall and Anonymous.
Yes, I didn't see Stonewall, but, well, you know. But, you know, I don't know. I was expecting this to be a decent film. And I'm shocked that it wasn't.
Well, we'll wait and see if we get a resurgence in a few years' time with a third sequel. But any other? I think we've said enough about Independence Day. Unless there's any last thoughts.
Just one thing I'll add is that it's. I mean, what can you say about a script where, you know, they, Will Smith isn't here. He's not back. And so they have to sort of deal with the fact that he's not there. And we're told that he died in a test flight. It's like, wow, really? That's that great backstory. I mean, couldn't you come up with something like maybe he died trying to save his son or something? I mean, it's just that's symptomatic of how this movie is so, like, we don't even care. We're just going to, like, we were going to go on name only, and you're going to come see it because you liked the first film.
There's words given to kind of serve why Smith's not there.
There's a painting of him in one room.
Yeah, there's
remind us that, hey, he's not here.
I think there's one reference to Randy Quaid's farmer character from the first film that's very
– Where's his son, by the way?
Why would he be involved?
They don't even address that.
Why would his son be involved?
You're talking about like the part like that was played by James Duvall and
yeah.
Why would he do that though? What would he do?
Well, why is Vivica A. Fox? You know,
she's the wife of Will Smith, and her son's a fighter pilot. Of course, she'd be there.
I mean, if you're gonna find, and I like Joey King as an actress, I'm glad she's getting work. But if you can find a random arbitrary plot for four kids that we're never gonna see again to have Judd Hirsch, someone, you know, give someone for Judd Hirsch to drive around,
that would make
you can
sense.
Find time. Yeah. You can find time for, you know, actual characters we gave a crap about 20 years ago.
So okay, so there's
I don't think you can spoil this film, but I mean, like, Vivica A. Fox's character's trajectory is not good.
It goes
like,
very down.
If you came to see this movie for her, you're not going to be happy. And I don't know. I mean, like the who is it? The woman that played the president's daughter, was it Mae Whitman? She's an actress in her own right, and they decided, oh no, we're not going to cast you. We're gonna cast. Was it Micah Monroe?
Yeah.
Yes.
From It Follows.
So they cast her instead. And I mean, you can go into reasons why they recast that part, and I don't like the reasons, but I mean, this is just stuff that I'm piling on that I've already didn't like the movie, so now I'm just adding stuff to it. But I'm not a fan of those casting changes, and I think Micah Monroe is a fine actress, but I didn't think there was a reason to recast her part. So
maybe Whitman just read the script.
I've read the background, and she was not even invited. Or I think
there's no real like official statement.
She had to read for the part. Like, why does someone who played the part originally have to read for it? But whatever.
Yeah.
There's no reference at all to Jeff Goldblum's wife from the first film.
None. Again, that's a primary arc in the first film.
Yeah. Right. She's sort of replaced in spirit by Charlotte Gainsbourg. I mean, that's now his new sort of. Squeeze.
Who's playing like the kind of like the random scientist played by like an actress that could like I guess need the paycheck like Sally Hawkins in Godzilla or Julia Binoche also in Godzilla.
You can see this. You know this. It's like the great actress that does art films that all of a sudden finds themselves in this big box office, you know, sort of wannabe box office hit. Yeah, it's interesting that's sort of the role that she's playing in this movie.
Maybe Lars von Trier just said, you know what, go for it.
Well, I mean, really, I'd love to ask her, like, what was it about this script that made you want to do this film?
Well, after I made Melancholia, I wanted to make a movie where the world didn't blow up at the end.
Well, I mean, you know, not to be dismissive, but money. You know, she's only on the set for probably a couple weeks.
Right, that's,
she gets at least what she would have gotten for being full-time on an artier film. And she gets her name out there.
And you know,
she
stays.
Yeah.
All right. Then we've talked plenty about Independence Day Resurgence. When would you say people should go and see this movie, Mark?
I would say you could rent it on DVD. You know, and play a game. First one to fall asleep is the loser, or the winner.
Scott?
Whatever the case may be.
As much as I hate you, I generally say, oh, see it in IMAX, just on principle. But I did see it in IMAX, and DVD, it's not a good film. It doesn't deserve your money. And there's, you know, there are certainly, you know, failed sequels this year that I'd say, oh, that's a shame. Neighbors 2, for example, or even something like Free State of Jones that I didn't like, but I'm not happy that it's flopping. But something like this, no. It doesn't deserve your pity.
Yeah, if there's like a cheap matinee showing, I mean, big things look fun to me, seeing giant explosions on the screen, like something in an Independence Day movie. But otherwise, yeah, renting it on Blu-ray, that'd be fun. All right, so Independence Day Resurgence, not quite the 4th of July spectacular that we were hoping for. All right, well, let's move on then. Let's get to our sponsor real quick. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Why Audible? Audible content includes more than 180,000 books and other similar programs for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or any kind of MP3 device. Additionally, Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook download of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/outnowpodcast. You can choose a book to download for free. Just start listening. It's that easy. audibletrial.com/outnowpodcast. Get a book for free. Check out the service. If you don't like the service, you can get rid of it, but you get to keep that book that you download for free. So be a winner. Read or listen at audibletrial.com/outnowpodcast. All right, moving on now. Let's get to our feedback.
Feedback.
Thank you, Mark.
I almost feel like you paused waiting for me to do that.
I did. That's exactly what happened.
Right.
So this is where we go over the various questions and answers on our Facebook page, facebook.com/outnowpodcast, where we asked a number of questions, and you listeners gave us answers. And so I'm going to go over all of those right now. And Scott and Mark, feel free to lend your own thoughts on these if you have any. First, a question here. Favorite alien spacecraft, perhaps aside from Star Wars, I added on there. Jason wrote, the ship from Firefly, which is, of course, the Serenity. Spencer writes, the Milano from Guardians of the Galaxy, since Star Wars is unable to be picked from. Justin writes, I would add just about every craft in Guardians of the Galaxy is pretty awesome looking, right down to those mining pods. Joe writes, the alien spacecraft in Prometheus, which I believe was the Prometheus. Unless he's talking about the other ship that, like, fell on people that didn't know how to live right, run left. Justin writes, The Last Starfighter. Philip writes, The Mothership from Close Encounters is pretty iconic. I'd agree. Tyler writes, The Eagle 5 Winnebago from Spaceballs. And then writes, The Serenity. Any other thoughts on alien ships?
Not off the top of my head.
How about from Alien, the Nostromo?
The Nostromo, that's a good one. I like that. Let's see. Next up here, favorite alien weapon seen in movies. Justin writes, I would think the lightsaber would be just a given. Best alien weapon has to be the Predator suit. When I saw that film the first time in theaters, it scared me so bad I feared the forest. Philip writes, the Predator's triangulating missile exploding thingy with the wrist and cool sound effect. Jason writes, lightsaber, and yes, it is an alien weapon. Tyler writes, lightsaber. And Joe Jans writes, Men in Black's noisy cricket. Let's see. What director would you like to see tackle a disaster film? Philip writes, Wes Anderson gave us a glimpse in Moonrise Kingdom. I'd like to see him go all out. Kevin Smith, from Joe, he writes, oh wait, he already made a disaster film. It was called Jersey Girl. Oh, shots fired. Tyler writes, Tarantino, because not enough disaster movies have Samuel L. Jackson. Manish writes, maybe someone like Bigelow or Matthew Vaughn. And Jason writes, Joss Whedon, because why not? I'd argue you kind of did in the last act of Avengers. Let's see. Next question we have here. Will Smith was obviously absent from Independence Day Resurgence. What are some films that could have benefited from, of all things, adding Smith to the cast? Manish writes, I'm not sure if the film would have benefited from Will Smith being in it, but I'm curious to see what he would have brought to Django Unchained, which is obviously a reference to when he was considered for the role before Jamie Foxx took the part. Spencer writes, what movie isn't enhanced by Will Smith? Without him, we wouldn't have had the gloriousness that is the movie Concussion. Philip writes, I'd like to see a buddy cop movie with him and Dwayne Johnson with a lot of drama and just a little humor. And Tyler writes, nothing because Will Smith's an overrated actor. More shots fired. let's see. Favorite Jeff Goldblum film? Jason writes, Jurassic Park, because who can really hate Dr. Ian Malcolm? Dennis and Manish both write The Fly. Justin writes, Earth Girls Are Easy. Philip writes, Buckaroo Banzai. Tyler writes, he was great in Wes Anderson's films, Life Aquatic and The Grand Budapest Hotel, as well as Jurassic Park. David writes, come on, guys, it's clearly The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai across the eighth dimension. You guys have a favorite Goldblum film?
Nobody said Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
No one did.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if that's my favorite, but it's one I like a lot.
I lean at The Fly. I agree, Scott. It's, as far as seeing all shapes and sizes of Goldblum, he's doing everything there.
That's probably his best role, yeah.
Let's see. Favorite Bill Pullman movie? David writes Spaceballs. Jason writes Independence Day as President Lone Star. Susan writes Casper. Joe writes Sleepless in Seattle. Manish writes While You Were Sleeping. Two sleeping movies. Philip writes Wyatt Earp. Jateman writes Not a Movie, but Torchwood Season 4. And Justin writes Malice. Any thoughts?
Ruthless People? Come on. No?
Zero Effect is my answer. I love Zero Effect.
I do love Spaceballs. That would be my pick. But I just want to give a little love for Lost Highway.
Yeah, all right.
Fair enough.
All right. Now we have some questions. You guys asked us, we got a number of questions here this week, actually. And so I'm going to go over these here so we can all participate in this. Tyler asks, The idea of continuing a franchise decades after the last installment is becoming a popular trend in modern cinema. Do you think this could continue to grow continue as a growing trend, such as immediate sequels or remakes? Also, why do you think they are they generally don't do as well as some other sequels that tend to break the previous installment's box office records?
Well, I think every franchise is different. And I think the mistake that we're seeing right now is assuming that, you know, again, I never thought the film was, you know, Independence Day was going to do Jurassic World business, but I think it was expected to reconnect in a vaguely similar way compared to that franchise last year. You had a lot of same elements. You had, with the caveat or with the addition of a returning cast members, not Will Smith, but I think when the film was announced, it was sort of like, hey, we've got the old gang back together. When, you know, now we realize that wasn't entirely the case. You know, Mae Whitman's missing. Will Smith is missing. The kid that played Will Smith's stepson in the first film's missing. James Duvall's missing. But, you know, several actors have died.
I mean, aside from some of those, you know, the minor characters, do you think if Will Smith was in this, it would be a bigger thing?
I think it would be a slightly bigger thing. But honestly, I'm not sure where it even fit in this film. You know, I was watching it.
Well, it reshaped the pilot's thing. Like, it wouldn't have, where, like,
I guess if he's sort of like the James Tobin character of the pilots, and the,
well, like, you wouldn't have Liam Hemsworth.
I think it would have helped, but I still think there are serious problems even with the way that the drama plays out with the effects and the destruction and all that. It would not have been enough to save the film, but it would have helped.
I think there could have been, like, there'd be more like a father-son drama. Like, you'd replace Hemsworth with Smith's character, right? And, like, there'd be just drama between the two of them over, like, his son doing stuff he doesn't like him doing or whatnot, and you'd have to go from there.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of filled the void that is the blankness that is all those new pilots in that area, I think. But for Tyler's question, you know, do you think this is a growing trend? Do you think more?
I don't think so, because
there's only so many franchises to keep latching on to.
Yeah, exactly. That, and frankly, enough of them aren't going to work that you're going to hopefully, God forbid, realize that, you know, Star Wars was a special case. Jurassic World was a special case. Creed sold itself as an original picture with a loose connection to the old Rocky franchise.
Well, I think that's the thing. You need to bring something new if you're going to do something like that. I mean, certain movies have a level of, you know, there's an iconic nature to them, so it works. But giving you more of something just because you can isn't always going to work. Like, that's why I hesitate I roll my eyes every time someone brings up Beetlejuice 2 or whatnot, because it's like there's nothing to gain out of this beyond the fact that you're seeing a movie that you could just watch already, but seeing it again with actors that are older and less committed to these ideas in a script that's kind of half-baked just for the sake of putting them on screen again.
And, you know, I mean, at least, you know, Star Wars The Force Awakens kind of hid the fact that it was somewhat of a remake of the first film until it actually came out. You know, this film, okay, yes, obviously The Force Awakens is a better film than, you know, Independence Day regardless, but this film, basically, its primary marketing gimmick was, hey, look, it's the same movie again, but bigger. Jurassic World didn't do that. That had a new gimmick. Hey, look, the park is open. That's neat. That was a story that was worth telling. Whether you liked the movie or not, that was a hook that got people into the theaters. And it looked more entertaining. And you had a fresh new star in Chris Pratt, who may not be an open-it-by-yourself movie star, but he's a likable guy that people know and like. You know, I think if you couldn't get Will Smith, you needed somebody like that to bring an added value element to this film other than just, oh, it's a remake of the first film, but Jeff Goldblum's kind of got a bigger part this time around.
Oh, but the classic comedy chops of Liam Hemsworth didn't do that?
Sadly, it did not. And, you know, it's I remember the day he was cast. It was like, oh, God, this is really – and, you know, I convinced myself otherwise last year because, again, I liked the last few Emmerich films, so I figured this would be – and, I convinced myself that it would be this giant post-9/11 parable that it's not. You know, I sort of dreamed up reasons, artistically viable reasons for doing an Independence Day sequel and assumed that Roland Emmerich would be – you know, actually looking for a reason to do Independence Day sequel when I don't think that's the case. Or if it was, that it's the third film, not this one, that he was actually interested in. But again, that's I think the film was victimized by franchise mentality, which is that you sabotage the second film to make sure you have material for the third film.
So let's move on to the next question. Joe writes, have you seen the documentary The Death of Superman Lives? What Happened? And if so, which one person do you think was truly to blame? I've got my money on John Peters. I've seen this. Have you guys seen this documentary?
I have.
I have not, no.
It's the film that chronicles the attempt to make a Superman film directed by Tim Burton starring Nicolas Cage, and it had all sorts of problems. All kinds of screenwriters came on, and all kinds of concepts and whatnot were thrown out, and eventually the movie was just canceled completely. As far as someone to blame, John Peters is that's a good one to point to. He was a producer involved that had a lot of very wild ideas of what to do, which both took away from who Superman was and made the budget skyrocket. That said, the movie they were coming up with could have been quite interesting. That's the walk away I have from the what I've read about in regard and on this documentary regarding that film.
I mean, I have seen the documentary, and you know, I was just old enough. Well, I mean, you were probably old enough too to be following this as it was going down back in, you know, 97, 96, 98.
Yeah.
And I was of the opinion that, you know, I was glad it got canceled because it did at the time. It didn't seem like anyone, you know, Burton was just coming off of Mars Attacks, which was a giant flop. Ed Wood was a financial flop. Artistically, it was very acclaimed, and it was sort of like, oh well. It was sort of a desperation grab, like Harrison Ford doing Indiana Jones 4 after Firewall. And I actually read the Kevin Smith script. The first act is excellent. The rest of it wasn't all that good. So I think the myth of, you know, Hollywood coming in and ruining Kevin Smith's precious script is somewhat false. As far as who's to blame, I don't think anyone is to blame because I think it's a movie that probably shouldn't have been made in the first place. So in this case, regardless of what else happened with the Superman franchise, I think Tim Burton's career is in a better place because he, you know, didn't do Superman, made Sleepy Hollow instead.
I can agree with that. It's just more of seeing where Superman is now, I am more curious about what this would have been. That's kind of my logic on that.
I think it would either be, you know, and obviously this is 50-50. It would have either been, you know, a giant step forward in the mainstream embrace of truly fantastical elements in a comic book movie, or it would have been such a huge flop that, you know, we wouldn't have even gotten X-Men.
Mark, what were you saying?
Well, is the idea that this would have been, like, this is some long-lost great film that never got made?
Not necessarily. It's a very bizarre take on the Superman character because it's coming from Tim Burton, who, you know, if Superman's about optimism, red, white, and blue, truth, justice, the American way, Tim Burton's not really that kind of filmmaker. So seeing the ideas that were being put forward based off both John Peters' suggestions and just Tim Burton's sensibilities as a director, it's not like the Superman I necessarily want to see, but if Tim Burton's making a Superman movie, I'm certainly curious.
This sort of reminds me of this documentary I saw a year or two ago called Jodorowsky's Dune, Have you seen that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I can't comment on this movie that we're talking about now, but this movie that we see in the documentary, Dune, looks – I cannot believe it would have been a success. It looks – I think he has some wild ideas, and I think he's very creative. I do not think that this movie would have ever been a success.
Well, like, David Lynch's Dune wasn't a success either, so it didn't work out either way.
And that's sort of why this documentary I think is sort of interesting because it's like, oh, well, this would have been the definitive Dune, the one that would have made, you know, his Dune look terrible. I mean, it wasn't well received anyway. But he had this – if you've seen the documentary, he's a very interesting director.
Yes. All right, next question here. Jason asks, what film do you think would have benefited from either Nick Cage or Jeff Goldblum in it? For me, The Happening needed some Nick Cage action. If you put Goldblum in Jurassic World, that could have given it some... I mean, I like Jurassic World as it is, but I don't know.
I don't know.
Anything you throw Nick Cage or Jeff Goldblum into...
Like together, or either one or the other.
I like the idea of together, but one or the other is the question.
Well, I would think that Independence Day Resurgence would have benefited from Nick Cage.
If you threw Nick Cage in there as one of the pilots, replace Liam Hemsworth and Nick Cage, you got to show a movie.
Oh yeah. Well, you replace Liam Hemsworth with anyone, I think it would have been an improvement.
You replace Liam Hemsworth with Chris Hemsworth, you got yourself a movie.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh.
All right, Philip asks, what are some of your comfort food type movies that you like to rewatch as a pick-me-up?
You know what's a movie I like? It's not like my favorite film, but it is kind of comfort food. I've seen it many times. Is Clueless. I think that's a fun film.
I don't necessarily have time to sort of whip out a DVD and, but I do. You know, I've watched Spy several times since it started airing on HBO. And it's one of those movies that I end up watching pretty close to the end, whether I intend to or not. And it was one of my favorite films from last year anyway, but I think I've seen that one more than any other film from last year.
Shaun of the Dead is one for me. Shaun of the Dead used to be a movie I put in a lot.
Well, for doing it used to be, I can play that game, actually.
Well, I mean, right now, yeah. I agree. I don't have, like, all
Shanghai
the
Shanghai Nights.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, it's no secret how much I adore that silly little movie. Obviously, Burton's Batman.
Well, yeah, Burton's Batman, that's a good game. And, I mean, if you're going to go there, I mean, Star Wars and Indiana Jones movies are pretty easy to be like Slider.
Yeah.
All right, next question. Justin, final question. Justin asks, what movie have you seen from your childhood recently that still holds up, aside from Star Wars, Indiana Jones, which I will be introducing my boys to soon? Any recent childhood memory movies that you've watched?
Ooh. Let me think.
I watched
Babe is still awesome.
The original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the one with Gene Wilder, that always holds up. I mean, I saw that as a child and I still love it.
Babe. I mean, I was 15, but it's still one of my favorites. Mean Girls has aged remarkably well. Again, I was 24, but, you know. Obviously, the first two Burton Batman films.
I mean, Back to the Future, that still holds up.
Think of like something old that I watch. I can't.
Star Trek VI. I liked it a lot when I was a kid. I like it even more now.
All right. I might hold on to this one because I want to hear what Abe would have to say about this. All right. That was not enough feedback.
Feedback.
Let's now it is it's time to get to some games.
Oh boy.
All right. That was, of course, the improv theme for games. And I have a game for you guys to play this week. It is called It Is the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. This is a game that all the answers are either disaster films or some kind of film where the world has ended, essentially. And so what I have here, I have either a quote or a tagline for each answer. And you guys have to, I'm going to read one or the other. And you guys buzz in with your name and tell me if you think you know which movie I'm going over. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. Here's the first one. This one could be pretty easy. Or could it? You don't actually think they spend $20,000 on a hammer, $30,000 on a toilet seat, do you?
Oh, it was...
Oh, ding?
Say your name.
Scott?
Yes.
The Rock?
Nope.
That's not a disaster.
No, it's not.
I mean, Central Intelligence?
No. That's not a disaster movie either.
Oh. I'm an idiot. Can I still guess?
I'm going to read the tagline, The Day We Fight Back. Okay, Scott, what is it?
Independence Day.
It's Independence Day, yes.
No, why? I thought it was The Rock. There's a scene from The Rock. Yeah, whatever.
Okay, Scott, pick either quote or tagline. Which one do you want to hear?
Tagline.
It's closer than you think.
That doesn't help.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, Scott.
Yeah?
Deep Impact?
Nope. You're very close, though.
Oh, well then.
Mark, you have an answer?
Oh, Mark, Armageddon?
Armageddon is the correct answer.
That was the other one.
Mark, do you want a quote or a tagline?
Quote.
I like Shrek. I'm going to read the tagline. The last man on Earth is not alone.
Scott.
Scott?
I Am Legend.
I Am Legend is the correct answer.
I love that tagline.
He likes Shrek.
I also like Shrek.
I'm going to read the quote for this next one because it's a long one and I like it. A man walks into a bar with a giraffe. They both get pissed. The giraffe falls over. The man goes to leave and the bartender says, "Oi, you can't leave that lion there." And the man says, no, it's not a lion. It's a giraffe. No sense of humor. That's still part of the quote. I'm going to read the tagline now.
Please.
The days are numbered.
Oh, Scott.
Yeah?
28 days later?
28 days later is the correct answer. Okay, Scott, do you want a quote or a tagline?
Tagline.
Free your mind.
That's not helpful.
I'm going to read the quote. Guns. Lots of guns.
Oh, Scott.
Yep.
The Matrix.
The Matrix is the correct answer. Okay, do you want a tagline or a quote, Scott?
Tagline.
Oceans rise, cities fall,
Scott.
Hope survives. Oh. Scott?
Deep Impact.
Deep Impact is the correct answer. Okay.
Tagline?
Okay. Some will kill to have it, he will kill to protect it. Here's the quote.
Mark,
yeah?
The Book of Eli?
The Book of Eli is the correct answer. Nice.
Who runs Bordertown? Gary Oldman runs Bordertown.
Exactly. Okay, Mark, do you want a quote or a tagline?
Let's do tagline this time.
The future is history.
Oh.
I'm going to read the quote. You had a bullet from World War I in your leg, James. How did it get there?
Oh, Mark. Stop.
Mark, I heard Mark.
Yeah, it's
12 monkeys.
12 monkeys is the correct answer.
It's the best time travel movie ever.
Okay, Mark, do you want a quote or a tagline?
We'll do a tagline.
We were warned.
Oh, these sound so familiar.
The quote may or may not help, but it's a good quote from the movie.
Oh, I know. By the Mayans. 2012.
That is correct.
Yes.
I'm going to read the quote anyway. I'm not scared. No more pull-ups. The last, and then John Cusack replies, nice. And that's the end of the movie. All right. Mark, do you want a quote or a tagline?
Tagline.
Okay. An adventure beyond the ordinary.
Scott?
Yes.
Wally?
Wally is the correct answer. And I just watched Wally. It's still delightful.
Very melancholy.
Yes, it is, but it's also about a robot who inspires people.
Yes.
Let me see. Let me add these up here because I have a tiebreaker one. Let me see. It looks pretty close. All right. Here we go. Here's the tiebreaker question. I'm going to do the quote, too. I didn't even have a tagline because I wanted this to happen. Oh, my God. I'm home all the time. It was. We finally did it.
Oh, Scott?
Yeah.
Planet of the Apes?
Planet of the Apes is the correct answer.
Of course.
All right, Scott. You win this game. You win the round of games.
What do I win?
What do you win? You get a chance to come back to the show, of course. What else?
That's not a prize. You would invite me back anyway.
Sounds like the best prize I could offer.
Until
I get a win or two of the banner contest, they get a much better prize than just getting on the show.
Oh, I recommended Milk Money.
Yeah. All right. That was games. Let's
Angels
move on.
In the outfield?
Yep. Let's move on. Let's move on to What's Out Now. These are movies that are coming out on Blu-ray or DVD this week. We have a few here. First up, Kung Fu Panda 3.
Yeah.
I like Kung Fu Panda 3.
I didn't dislike it, but it was a come down from the first two.
The first two are better, yes. Eye in the Sky.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
I it's very good. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
I enjoyed that.
I did not like that.
That was fine. Clouds of Sils Maria comes out on Criterion this week. That was last year at this point. But that was, is it Binoche?
Yep.
Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart.
Kristen Stewart playing
very,
herself.
Very, very good movie.
And she was convincing.
Let's see. 2 Minute Warning is out on Shout Factory this week. And why did I pick this movie? Because it... what's the plot? It's, I believe there's like a terrorist threat like during like a football game, and Charlton Heston's like the police, the cop trying to figure it out.
Huh.
Yeah.
This is an old movie.
It's an old movie. Yes, an old movie. It's from Shout Factory, so they're big enough older films, older genres.
Oh, okay.
And lastly, also on Criterion, Doctor Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, one of my favorite movies of all time. It has a what looks like a fantastic Criterion Collection release this week. I can't wait to check it out myself. It actually fits well with Eye in the Sky to a point, actually. All right, so that was what's out now. Let's get to extremely cool. These movies that are now on Netflix that I can recommend. The first one up is The Fundamentals of Caring. This is a film that was picked up at Sundance. It stars Paul Rudd and Craig Roberts from one of Mark Hoban's favorite films, Submarine.
Right. Did not enjoy that film.
I know. That is like a 2011 reference, I think, right there.
Yeah, you have good memory. Most people probably don't even remember that film.
I know, but...
And I know I was in the minority, as critically anyway. I know that was a critically acclaimed film.
But this film, The Fundamentals of Caring, it stars Paul Rudd as he becomes like a caretaker. And Craig Roberts plays like a guy with it's not muscular dystrophy. It's another kind of dystrophy, though, where he's in a wheelchair. And it's like a buddy road trip comedy. And it's fine. I checked it out. It's fine. I think it's whatever. It's nothing particularly special, but it's because it has like that indie cred from Sundance and Netflix acquired it. I guess it's supposed to be a big deal. But I like Paul Rudd, and I like the kid in Submarine. I like Craig Roberts, so I checked it out. And next up is Ip Man 3, featuring Mike Tyson. I have not watched Ip Man 3 yet, but I do like the first two Ip Man films, and I'm very curious. But I do like seeing Donnie Yen's fist flying a fury in those other Ip Man movies. Are you guys a fan of the Ip Man films? Have you seen them by chance?
I have not.
Yeah, I'm not real familiar with it. I mean, I'm aware of it, but mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's also the Grandmaster, which with the that was the other film based off the character Ip Man from what's his name, the director.
Donnie Yen.
No, Donnie Yen is Ip Man in these new Ip Man films. Oh. This one. What's his name from the Wong Kar-wai. Wong Kar-wai directed The Grandmaster, which is kind of the artsier version of Ip Man, essentially. But anyway, there's a third Ip Man movie, and it's now on Netflix. All right. Moving on now. Let's see. Next week's show. Next week, we'll probably be talking the BFG, and because it's our kind of midway through the year, we'll be doing our kind of best of the year so far. So Abe and I will have that along with our guests who I get on for that show. Oh, yeah, the BFG comes out next week. We'll be talking about that film. And if we feel like talking about The Legend of Tarzan, that might come up as well. And last thing we do here, what should people go and see now, and what do you plan to see next? Mark Hoban, what should people go and see in theaters right now?
Well, I would say Finding Dory. That's probably the best thing out right now. I will say I did like a movie called Love and Friendship. It's by Whit Stillman, and it's sort of an adaptation of a what's her name? Jane Austen novel. And I actually quite liked it. It's in limited – I'm not even sure if it's still playing anymore. But it was in limited release, and I enjoyed that quite a bit.
What are you going to see next?
Next, I'm going to see the BFG.
Scott Mendelson, what should people see in theaters right now?
BFG is good. See it when it comes out. The Central Intelligence is very enjoyable. The Nice Guys, if it's still in a theater near you, it needs your money. It's excellent. It's not doing that well, so support it while you can. Next, I will be seeing on Tuesday The Purge Election Year.
Good luck.
That's it. Purge night. Awesome. After that, it's just a question of how quickly Sony's willing to show us Ghostbusters.
All right. I don't need your whole schedule, yeah. Scott. I got it. You're okay. Let's see. I would recommend Hunt for the Wilder People if you can find it. I know it's in a limited release, and I hope it's spreading soon. Very good. Very good film. Let's see. Yeah, I agree with The Nice Guys. Abe and I have been recommending that one. It's still in some theaters. And I've also been recommending The Lobster. I keep saying The Lobster.
Oh, right. Yes.
You know what I want to see? I think you've seen it, Aaron.
Swiss Army Man?
Wiener Dog. By Todd Solondz.
Yes, I
always find his movies very interesting. Even when they're sort of off-putting, they're still fascinating. So I do want to see that. Yeah. I think it's very limited right now. But
It's certainly a film for Todd Solondz fans, that's for sure. It has this kind of...
Well, I liked Dark Horse a lot.
It definitely has his off-putting sense of humor. I would say that for sure.
Off-putting is kind of his. I mean, you know, Welcome to the Dollhouse, Happiness. These are his his big successes. So
yeah, if you're a fan of, you know, if you're a fan of offbeat comedy, that's the route to go. And it's got a good ensemble cast in there. Danny DeVito and Ellen Burstyn pop up, and they're both very good in the movie. But yeah, next up, I will be seeing the BFG with Anna. We actually just finished reading the book together, which was a lot of fun. And yeah, that's going to do it for this week's episode of Out Now with Aaron and Abe. You can find more of my work on my personal blog, thecodeofzeke.com. You can find all my written movie reviews there. You can also find me writing daily news stories over on screenrant.com, and you can find me on Twitter at aaronsps4. There's no Abe. Mark Hoban, where can people find more of your work online?
You can find more of my work on my personal blog, fastfilmreviews.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter, Mark_Hoban.
Scott Mendelson.
I write for Forbes. Forbes.com. You can Google the ticket booth, Scott Mendelson. That will bring it up.
All right. You can find all the other episodes of Out Now with Aaron and Abe over on iTunes as well as on Audio Boom. You can also check us out on SoundCloud and hhwlod.com for our past episodes. You can feel free to email us your thoughts on what we've talked about this week for Independence Day or anything else at outnowpodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to follow us over on Facebook or Twitter, facebook.com/outnowpodcast or twitter.com/outnow_podcast. And, of course, we have our Tumblr page for some reason that's still not determined by Abe and I at outnowpodcast.tumblr.com. Scott and Mark, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
For sure. And I look forward to talking about a Spielberg film, so I look forward to seeing it as well. So yeah, until next time, that's going to do it for this week. So long and goodbye. A man walks into a bar with a giraffe. They both get pissed. The giraffe falls over. The man goes to leave, and the bartender says, "Oi, you can't leave that lion there." And the man says, "No, it's not a lion. It's a giraffe."